Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Ashkan Kazarian. On today's show, we're going to preview IGF USA, what it is, what it's going to do, when it takes place, and who's going to be there. Joining me, I have Shane Tews and Steve Del Bianco. Shane is a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and Steve is the president and CEO of NetChoice. Shane, Steve, thank you so much for joining me.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Ash. So guys, you have been with IGF USA for a while, as I know. Let our listeners know what it is, how it started.
So a little bit of history. The Internet Governance Forum was started really as sort of a third way. And the Internet Governance Forum, not just here in the United States, but as a international forum. There was a challenge of ICANN when it was still in its sort of nascent.
And ICANN is?
The Internet Corporation on Assigned Names and Numbers, which was created in 1997 by a green paper, which became a white paper under the Clinton administration by some very smart women. Becky Burr and Karen Rose were the key people because Larry Irving believed in embracing women in tech. So so the ICANN was a way of taking the domain name addressing system and moving it outside of the U.S. government, and they created a multi-stakeholder process. The International Telecommunications Union has always challenged the notion that the DNS should not sit outside of them because they would like to run everything. And then the IGF was created with a kind of a middle way to say, can we find a way to bring governments in more into the fold that don't choose to be full participants of ICANN and keep the multi-stakeholder process, which was created really under ICANN and has grown, and we reflect that in the Internet Governance Forum USA. All of that is to say, at first, we did not have an IGF USA because we really kind of had a bit of an arrogant point of view of we kind of started this thing, and there were so many people within the United States and the U.S. government that were engaged. So it took us a little while. There are actually Western Africa and Eastern Africa used to have their own IGFs, and other countries started doing these meetings. And what was interesting about that was they each had the flavor of the challenge they were having with network opportunities and the internet at that stage. And this is in the early 2000s going to the mid 2000s. And it was really interesting to go to the international IGF and see what challenges, Kenya was doing a great job getting a new landing cable and bringing more technology and more internet to the eastern side of Africa, and Western Africa was trying to figure out how to emulate that. One of the big boosts for Africa was actually the World Cup, when it was in South Africa and they were able to get some more landing cables to connect. So all that is being a way to say it took us a while to get our act together, but we did it. And what we try to focus on the current challenges that the multi-stakeholder process see in what's going on in the United States. So we're not necessarily looking to reflect everything that's going on globally. Sometimes the challenges, like right now in Vietnam, they are looking to really curtail how much internet access the people of Vietnam have, and we, those of us who believe in freedom of the internet are not in favor of that, but that's not something that we're necessarily going to tackle at IGF USA. So we start meeting in January, and we've already had 7 steering committees this year, and we Steve can go into the kind of heavier details if you wish about how much we put into doing surveys, making sure that everyone feels it's an inclusive process as to the decisions that we make. Part of this is really at the end of the day, to be quite crass, we're putting on more or less a show that we want to have the best possible dialogue on the chosen topics. So that's a lot of the work that I know you've been engaged in. Steve has been heavily involved in, and I've been working on this for, I think, 5 years as some iterative of co-chair or vice chair. And so we're getting ready for this year's. We just opened up the Eventbrite ability to register today on the June 11th, whatever today is.
Today's the day of internet died, June 11th.
Oh, right. We didn't, I think, had that in mind, but yes, we were not looking to commemorate that in any way. So we are really going down to the final phases of choosing the people that will be on the panels, and I'm going to let Steve kind of go through the topics, and I'm happy to chime in.
And before we go through the topics, just so people are very, very clear on what it is, Shane said it's a dialogue between different stakeholders. It's some sort of a conference too, right? It's open to public.
So this will be our third year at the Center for International Studies, CSIS, which is on Rhode Island Avenue. One of the reasons that we have kept it here in Washington is we found this is really the concentration of people that work on internet policy. My colleague, the other vice chair, Dustin Phillips, actually did a road trip in about a month ago that we're trying to see if we can get other areas to be interested to maybe have meetings throughout the year. And then one of our ability, if we can do that, is to then talk about that at the IGF that's held annually. And so that's a way to bring in other areas. You know, there's sometimes people mention Austin, Chicago, Boston, Seattle, LA, San Francisco are the big cities. But he actually went to Arizona. Arizona State's doing a lot of work in this space. And he went out and visited some Indian tribes. And so there's a lot of different stakeholders that are very excited about the internet and have some challenges they're trying to work through, and we're trying to highlight all of those.
So let's focus now on the panel. Steve, do you want to walk us through some of them?
Yeah, it's partly to explain why this really matters, because U.S. businesses, civil society, technical community, and U.S. government, well, we're pretty used to this multi-stakeholder model that Shane described that we used at ICANN for well over a decade. But the United Nations and the International Telecommunications Union, they don't do multi-stakeholders so well. Their belief of multi-stakeholder is that every government gets one vote and the only people with any votes are the governments. So this Internet Governance Forum, run by the United Nations, was a place where not only U.S. civil society, technical, and government could go, but the rest of the world would show up. And it occurred to us after the second or third year of the United Nations running the great IGF, it's a once-a-year event held around the world, is that we concluded that we needed to get together on the U.S. side before the big event and sort of get our act together with regard to the critical topics of the day that related to internet governance so that we could come over and present not a unified front from U.S. interests, but one where we had come up with a cohesive set of arguments, pros and cons for different approaches. And it let us contribute much more constructively to the dialogue that happened among those governments that gather at the UN. And with that sort of learning, we've come up with a series of 8 panels this year that focus on topics that are of vital interest to U.S. consumers and business and government, but also will play well into the broader global debate. I can give you a few examples sort of to kick things off. One will be called Trending Now: Real News Can No Longer Compete with Fake News. So with a title like that, you know what it's going to be about. We're going to try to define fake news to say that it's deliberate misinformation that's disguised as objective, but is actually designed to persuade readers or attract audiences for either economic purposes or for political purposes. And we're going to talk about scenarios on this session. So it's not your grandfather's panel discussion with a handful of talking heads. We start off by describing 3 different scenarios for what the future might look like in a few years. A dystopian future where nobody trusts anything they read on the internet. In the middle, a future where we have a hardening of these silos of opinion. So conservatives go to their silo of websites and liberals and progressives go to their silos of information, and never the two shall meet. And that, in many respects, is a dystopian dialogue, too, because the two sides just don't talk. And then the final scenario would be one where we come up with radical transparency about who pays for an ad or a sponsored content or story. And with that transparency instantly available to readers on the internet, they'll be much more likely to know who they can trust and how much they can trust about what they see online. So we contrast these 3 scenarios and invite a panel of experts to talk about ways we could avoid or embrace different aspects of those scenarios.
So what the scenarios allow you to do is get up to speed very quickly on, you know, how something may or may not be going in a direction that you think is relative. And we've done these in the past. Actually, we've done it at the International IGF, and they've been very helpful and successful in bringing people into a dialogue that they may think, I'm just going to go sit in this room and I may or may not learn something. I think almost everyone gets engaged. So I'm very excited. This was Steve's suggestion for this year that a couple of the groups have adopted this way of going through it. We've all sat through a lot of panel discussions. They're usually pretty interesting, but this is another way to convey a lot of information and actually in a really condensed fashion, and then get to the bigger discussion in a much more efficient way.
What other panels are doing this interactive way of learning and sharing information?
The scenario approach is being used on fake news, as we just covered, but it's also being used on a session on internet governance. And it's called Motion to Dismiss, where we're going to do a scenario where court decisions around the world are dismissing the policies and laws that the multi-stakeholder community had developed beforehand. And if we ended up presenting that with a handful of legal experts talking about GDPR or the right to be forgotten, we'll end up having disagreements among the experts on what exactly the ruling was or what the law in particular came down upon. This is what happens when you let legal experts debate what actually happened in the past. So scenarios, to Shane's point, flips that on its head. Instead of actually debating what did happen, a scenario is imagining a plausible future that could happen, and it might echo a lot of what we see today, but that invites the panelists to react to ways in which we want to avoid or embrace that. Just to give you an example on the internet governance side, we will talk about in 2019 or in 2020, we set up the scenario to say that the European Court of Justice has ordered Google to suppress global search results that were de-indexed pursuant to a right to be forgotten request that Google granted to a European citizen. One in case might be a German currency trader who requested delisting of his prior convictions for insider trading. We have another example where an Italian politician sought to delist all the negative media coverage of a prior corruption investigation. And when you tee it up that way, the experts can't debate what did happen. They just get to think about how do we stop this from disrupting what the multi-stakeholder community works so hard to do, which is to develop our own norms, only to have a court, often a single judge, issue a ruling with cross-border reach that instantly wipes out years of policymaking in another country entirely.
All right, so those are two panels. I'm going to do a shameless plug-in of a platform content moderation liability panel that I'm helping organize. We're also going to do an interactive scenario where we let the audience be the moderators of the online content, let them kind of make the sausage themselves. And decide, make a call on, should we take this down? Should we keep this content? Should we flag it? That will be the 80, 70% of a panel. Before that, we're going to have a panel of outstanding experts from industry, academia, and think tank world who are going to talk about the state of content moderation right now and the regulations and laws that exist on the books right now in US and in Europe and Canada, and kind of just like do a quick comparison to see how that affected the economies and development of platforms in general.
And looking at the way you've laid out that panel, Ash, it's also fascinating that you'll look at internal policies that companies come up with completely apart from laws and regulations. So when you look at website platforms like Facebook, Yelp, TripAdvisor, YouTube, or even Twitter, those companies try to create a safe space for their users, and they even make promises about the kind of content they'll permit and exclude. So the audience will be invited to pretend you're a content moderator at TripAdvisor. And when you're looking at potential posts from users, you'll have to decide whether they violate the policies that TripAdvisor has posted. I think it'll be a fascinating exercise to know what content moderation is like on a private platform, completely apart from what government's laws or regulations might dictate.
Absolutely, yes. So they will be given, the prompt will include the rules of that certain platform. We will probably have fake platforms, but they will be very easily recognizable. Some kind of a little parody and spoof on it, I would say. So, okay, so that's panel number three, not going really in chronological order or anything.
What's smart cities? We have a really good smart cities and Internet of Things panel that is getting coordinated. And that's actually a great example where we have people around the United States that are collaborating along with us. So we've already been able to identify, T-Mobile has a representative who's out in Seattle, who's been, Kim Sanchez has been very participatory on this. We've been talking to some of the mayors, perhaps the mayor of Kansas City may be able to fly in. There's some deputy mayors. And the reason for that is to see what are some smart applications that are already in play that other cities may want to emulate their success or understand their failures so they don't have to go through the expense of going through that. And there's some really interesting use cases For example, in Las Vegas, they have a trigger mechanism for wanting clean air, that if they have a lot of cars that are backing up and they realize the carbon monoxide is getting high, they will automatically change the lights. So they will go about five lights in to just push the traffic along. I mean, just things that I had not thought about until I think of IoT as really kind of more a machine to machine, doing things in a in more of an industrial setting. And these are things that we're going to see more and more of, especially with the advent of 5G coming online in the next couple of years. And you'll see a lot of local officials being engaged in those dialogues too. So understanding the importance of the smart city application to IoT and 5G, I think will be something that this panel will be highlighting as well.
And picking up on this notion of what's coming down the pike, one of the panels is on the futures of work. How will the internet change my job, change what I do for a living and how I engage with the work economy? And the internet, as we all know, has really changed the way we do the jobs that we have. But new technologies like artificial intelligence and automation actually have the potential to dramatically change our relationship to the world of work even more. We're going to lay out three distinct futures scenarios once again and facilitate an audience-wide discussion to try to discover which of these scenarios is most likely and which is most desirable. So briefly, one scenario is the full realization of the tech lash. And tech lash is slang for what we call here in Washington the big tech backlash that we see on hearings in Capitol Hill, in editorials, and often in academia around the country, as there's a sort of a groundswell of concern over the large tech platforms that have been dominating so much of our online activity. Another would be digital dependency. That'll be a scenario talking about individuals becoming perhaps too dependent on a digital exchange in order to earn a living. And then finally, a more optimistic scenario where online platforms actually lead the way for increased engagement by the American workforce. Maybe not in yet another 9-to-5, 40-hour week job for life, but engaging in some aspects of the economy where you have unique skills or assets, but having internet platforms be the matchmaker between you and the customers who want to use the skills and assets that you have.
All right. So that sounds very fascinating. I think people will have a very hard time deciding between the panels.
Well, so the way that the day is structured is we start at 8:00 with registration and we move into a keynote speaker. So we have David Reddle, the Assistant Secretary for the National Telecommunications Information Agency, NTIA, will kick off the day for us. And then we'll stay in the large room for a large plenary session, yet to be determined. Maybe by the time you listen to this podcast, we'll know who that's going to be. And then we're able, because this one of the great things about this location is we can break it down then into three separate rooms. That's when a decision might have to be made. But here's the good news. We simulcast all this and it's taped. So if you really wanted to see something and you were in the other room, you got to decide which dialogue you want to be live in and one you can just be informed by, those will be available later. And we do get a very large viewership actually globally on these issues. We'll break again for a quick lunch on campus. And then we will go to a second round of three breakout sessions. And then we come back for an afternoon plenary session, a large group. And then we have closing comments. And then we're done for the day.
And this all happens July 27th.
Yes.
I don't think we've said that yet.
July 27th.
We should say it a few times.
Yes. Center for Strategic and International Studies,
CSIS. That's a Friday.
It is a Friday. It's part of the challenge in Washington is space, because there's a lot of people that come to town, and that space has been one that's worked out very well for us. And because they use the space during the week, we have to go to a Monday or a Friday, and this particular group chose to take it on a Friday.
Well, it sounds like a great way to end your week by learning something new and meeting new people, and then having a reception afterwards,
Yes, we'll have a little cocktail ability for people to catch up afterwards. And just to let you know, for information, it is currently igf-usa.org, which has some history to it. We are going to be migrating eventually off that to igfusa.us. So that will be coming up just to make it easier for people to find it. If you go to igfusa.org right now, that they have lovely furniture. I'm not saying you shouldn't buy it, but it's probably not where you're headed. And then once you get to the igf-usa.org space, there's an ICANN wiki that can show all the work that Steve and I and you have been discussing to see how these decisions get made. It's a very open platform. We really pride ourselves on that, as well as just information on the day, people that you can contact, and the ability to make suggestions. So please go visit it. plan on attending, feel free to contact anybody who's in the planning process before the day, and we hope that you will actually attend.
So my last question to Steve and Shane, to both of you, would be, why did you get involved with this? What made you volunteer your time?
I really believe the multi-stakeholder process is the best way to ensure that the internet stays open and unfettered. And so I've been doing this work, as has Steve, for almost probably 20 years. And it's more important now as it ever has been. There's a lot of misunderstanding about how networks operate. We're very fortunate that the way technology tends to work is it's seamless. For anybody who's got a smartphone, you know that you don't really necessarily know how the app, you don't have to know the code. You just download an app and it does magical things on your smart device. Same with most computers. So, you know, we're very lucky. We live in a world where most of the people that we work with that aren't in technology, they don't understand how this stuff works, and it doesn't matter. It just works. But to keep that seamless nature and keeping it affordable and economic, and as Steve was talking about the future of work, how many things there are now that people can do because of the technology that it gives you the ability to be untethered from a desk and do what you want and still make a very good living. Those are all things that lead back to internet governance. I know that we're in Washington, we think about policy all the time, but policy matters.
Steve?
My interest and level of effort for the IGF USA really derives from the mission statement for the organization I lead called netchoice.org. And the mission is to make the internet safe for free expression and free enterprise. It's a simple statement, but it clashes with a very complex set of concerns and complaints that arise from different corners of society, both here in the USA, around the world, and it certainly arises from governments who realize the internet is awfully important. And governments then believe that anything that important, well, just has to be run by governments. So we feel like every year, the latest set of concerns and complaints about the internet, about big tech, about privacy in Europe, whatever it may be, that those complaints drive to a situation which will really restrict the freedom, investment, and innovation that we enjoy here in the United States, and that those will run headlong into concerns and complaints. So for me, IGF is a great opportunity to surface those issues, as Shane said, to educate an audience about what is happening underneath the covers with internet technologies, to try to surface distinctions they may not have realized, and to do a real world comparison between regulatory regimes that we may be hearing about in Europe and the regulatory regime that we've taken for granted here in the United States, where tech freedom has really been the way in which we've conducted ourselves.
Well, thank you guys for facilitating such an important dialogue. And before we wrap up, Shane, we've had you on the show before when Evan was hosting, when I took over, and we never asked you about your career path and how you ended up in technology world, in the tech policy world, even though when I think about women in tech, you're one of the first people I think about, if not the first one. So do you mind sharing with our listeners a little bit about, like, how did it all start for you?
The one thing though, I before this, I was a liquor lobbyist, and people always wonder, how do you go from A to B there? And it really is the interstate commerce clause, because that was a lot of what I was spending my time on, was the ability to not see the barrier of a state law in that case, or sometimes it was international shipping laws. And the dot-com boom was just going on when I went to go work for VeriSign, that just bought Network Solutions, which was the original ComNet and Org company. And it's a lot of it is just understanding, you know, what you can and can't do. And we're still having these struggles every day with, you know, what you can ship across the state line, whose taxes do you owe. I have a very libertarian bent, so I want to see less barriers to entry, and I want to see less taxation when possible. And those are things that were very interesting to the powers that be when I started working there. One thing that I have learned, so from a woman in tech perspective, is when I first started at VeriSign, there was a lot of, hey, this is math class. You know, when I walk into a room, these guys kind of look at me like, what are you doing here? Cheerleading's down the hall. And they eventually realized I was only there to help. And, you know, once we figured out the yin and yang of the importance of explaining technology to policy people on a level they could understand, we became a very trusted entity. Steve and I have worked a lot in that space together, because a lot of it is, I referenced earlier, don't necessarily have to understand the underlying tech, but you understand the ability to utilize it and really exploit's not the word I should be using, but explore the opportunities and the possibilities that technology brings. And I think the more you see women in this space, it doesn't feel as foreign. Math was never my hyper strong suit, but now I find myself thinking more and more mathematically because I do understand how the technology works. And so I hope that we see more women get engaged in this area because it's a great place to be, and it's a lot of where our future lies.
And I think you're one of the most modest people I've met in DC, which says something, because, you know, you're an expert on cybersecurity and cross-border and internet governance and so many topics that any person can make a career out of one of them. And I think it's also a very specific trait to A, women who have to be, you know, jack of all trades, and B, working in tech policy where no one issue is really secluded or siloed. You have to kind of dip into different parts of different issue areas to have a full picture. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes. I think a lot of what we do in the policy space is find analogies that allow people to understand something about the policy they may not understand the underlying reason why you're discussing it. And finding that nexus point so it makes sense to someone. Either it's a legislative director or somebody who's the director of policy or perhaps a member of Congress or a state senator. Once you've made that connection, I find they come back more and more often. When I first started talking about domain name addressing, I would just say to people, just hold on to my card, and when you finally have those questions, you'll know who to call. And years later, people call me and be like, you were that girl who came in my office that one day and we're talking about something I didn't understand. Now I need to know. And so it paid off, but a lot of it was I didn't want to appear too wonky or scare them away with a bunch of data that didn't matter to them. They needed to hear it in a way that was important to their perspective.
Yeah, and Shane, actually, you were the inspiration for me to get involved in internet governance at all. It happened 15 years ago when we were grappling with what seemed like an arcane contractual matter about the way VeriSign was running .com. But Shane had that capability of explain to an audience, before you tell them what happened, explain why they should care, both at a personal level, how they would interact with the technology, and maybe at a national level to understand why it matters for the success of an internet-driven economy. And with those kind of contextual backgrounds, I found that Shane almost always leads the way to tee up a discussion so that maybe the engineers and business people in the room can actually speak to an audience that is now prepared to appreciate why it matters.
I think we're seeing a lot of that right now with blockchain. Blockchain basically runs the same way the domain name addressing system is. You have a trust on the web. Not as many people type in a domain name as they used to, but you, except for the case of IGFUSA.org, where you go to a furniture site, usually you end up where you expect to be. And that's where, if you can understand your trust that you have, it's almost innate in the internet and how it functions. And now we're seeing that move on to something like blockchain technology. It makes it a lot easier for somebody to say, yeah, I'm going to want to bank with somebody who uses that transparent technology that I understand. I will always know where the transactions lie, et cetera, things like that.
And I just have to add that Shane was the inspiration and supporter when Tech Freedom was founded, and a very trusted advisor throughout the years, and the reason we are still around. So thank you, Shane, so much. And Steve, thank you for joining us. Thank you guys for giving this really great overview. We're going to link to all the information you mentioned in our show notes so the listeners can go to register for IGF, read more about, get involved, send us comments, questions, whatever they want to do. And I hope you will come on July 27th at 8 a.m. or maybe a little later if you're not an early morning person like I am.
It's an all-day affair. You're allowed to show up when it's good for you.
Yes, absolutely. And come to the center on
Center for Strategic and International Studies on Rhode Island Avenue.
Yeah, the address will also be linked. Thank you for listening. Please follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Tech Freedom and leave us a review if you want others to find us, or maybe send them a link to our show. We would appreciate any help. Thank you for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.